I'm wondering if we might just try a bit of a tremor, because I'm in a standing position. I'm thinking of what, and it might be the easiest. Let's try a one from a forward fold, which may also be familiar to people if you've done any kind of yoga or anything. So if you were standing. And you
Okay.
have a sense of your 2 feet beneath you, and there's kind of a moment of sea feeling, which is that your feet both have 3 points of contact, this little tripod of contact with the floor, your heels, and then one near your little toe and one near your big toe, and you can kind of that kind of structure is often helpful to feel beneath your hips, and then one can really just let the head fold forward, come forward, chin near your chest, and just allow your spine to kind of fold down into this forward fold position. So you're kind of hanging from your hip sockets so that your tailbone is in the air, your hands are near the floor somewhere. Knees are slightly bent, so you want them toward a bending rather than toward a locked
Rather
position. Yeah. And so yeah, so the knees are slightly bent, head is somewhere near your knees in this forward fold. And you can actually just kind of allow the body to breathe a little bit. And probably if you just stayed here long enough, a bioenergetic tremor would start, because your muscles would start to fatigue a bit.
This is Tongue in Cheek. Today I'm joined by Phil Timberlake,
But what we can do is we can actually bend the knees slightly.
who's both an actor and associate teacher of speech and voice at DePaul University in Chicago.
And then think of sending energy through the heels to very slowly straighten the knees.
This is sort of a mix between two different conversations that we've had in the past few months.
And I like to think in millimeters, really. Just little tiny stretches. And you can think about this as a dynamic effort, as you said, that there's a slight bending, millimeter or two, and then an extending through the heels or a straightening, a millimeter or two. And you probably find a little tremor, a little bioenergetic tremor. This is as your body's trying to figure out what you would like it to do. Would you like it to bend or would you like it to straighten? And one of the things about this position that you'll notice, and this is true in all the tremoring positions, is that there is no effort happening from between my hip sockets and my shoulder sockets and the torso, which allows the body to breathe as it wants, which means that the belly can kind of move like a sheet in the drying in the wind. And the ribs can swing up and out. They move kind of like bucket handles
From the spine, all of them attach at the spine, and then most of them attach somewhere along the sternum or the tuxedo cutaway of the rib cage.
And that little tremor just is engaging the autonomic nervous system so that the body starts to go, huh, what's going on? And if I start to breathe, I can be ready, just in a state of readiness for whatever's going to come next. Now, if you've got a little tremor going in your legs, you might be able to kind of unfold back to standing and still keep that tremor going. So you would keep the knees bent slightly, keep thinking of sending energy through the heels. You can kind of unfold the spine and whatever velocity suits you. And you're unfolding so that the spine kind of lengthens so that you end up with your skull on top of your spine. Jaw released, if that's possible. In other words, lips parted. And you might still be able to get a little bit of a tremor going. And here again, you don't really need a whole lot of muscles holding you up, which means you can experience the breathing from down in the hip sockets all the way to the shoulder sockets. The body can really find its breath coming and going on its own.
And then you can just kind of step out of that. All right.
The last conversation we had, we spoke through a class that that you regularly teach, which is a second semester, second year course in the MFA program.
Mm-hmm.
And but so maybe as a scope before that, before that conversation, I just wanted to sort of run through some things that have caught my interest in terms of your longer bio. I think it's important to note, first of all, that you are also a practicing actor.
Right.
And it's both a part of the base of your own training, but also currently in the Chicago area, or currently, I mean, obviously things are very different right now. But you've been a part of the Lifeline Theater since 2006, I believe.
Yeah.
And you've also worked with many other theaters around the
mm-hmm.
Chicago area, like the First Folio Theater, Apple Tree,
mm-hmm.
Power Tap, Shaw Chicago. And I think what's also interesting in terms of your relationship both to the Lifeline Theater, which seems to be kind of home-based ensemble, and also
yeah, for sure.
The other theaters that you're in involved with, is that beyond the acting roles that you've had, you've also played the role of voice coach
mm-hmm.
or a dialect coach throughout
mm-hmm.
those places. You are both an actor, and one of the roles of acting in some ways is being a coach or a teacher.
Yeah, to me it is. I think of myself as a teaching artist.
Mm-hmm.
And that both the practice of performance and developing theater work and my teaching are all kind of a part of the same continuum in a way.
And so you teach at DePaul University's Theater School in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're associate professor there of voice
mm-hmm.
and speech, and you teach
mm-hmm.
both in the MFA and the BFA program. You're associate teacher of Catherine Fitzmaurice Technique.
Mm-hmm.
You did a Fulbright in France at the Roy Hart Center and have a diploma
mm-hmm.
from Roy Hart. You,
yeah.
I know, beyond the fact that you grew up in a household with a music teacher, you also have always come back to two figures I've heard you say again and again, Arthur Lessac and Linkletter,
yeah.
as
yeah.
two very early inspirational figures.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if we could go back through the way that you described how you first became interested in teaching, which I from our last conversation, I think was right after you had your Fulbright at the Roy Hart Center and had
yeah.
come back.
Yeah, yeah. I had spent a Fulbright year at the Roy Hart Art Center in France, and that work on the voice, which really explores the idea that there is a human voice that is a large, expansive in tone and pitch and quality, and is able to express the full expanse of human experience beyond what is often traditionally limited by aesthetics and society. And it was really profound for me as an artist, and I really didn't intend to teach. In fact, one of my teachers there said that they specifically remember me saying I did not want to teach, which I don't remember saying, but I swear that happened in a conversation while I was there. But when I got back and people would ask me about it, it was very difficult to describe what it was or why it was so meaningful for me. And so I just started saying, well, let's just play a little bit, and or let's find a piano, because the piano, which has its kind of eight octaves of possibility, it's a great roadmap guide, a bit of a kind of a teacher of its own. And so I just started kind of playing with, you know, sounding and using notes on the piano and improvising with other people. And I started to notice, well, I could hear things. I knew I was really hearing something. And then if I just ask the person to do something slightly different or move to a different pitch, that a change would happen. And that, and so I just started, it was really that kind of investigation of, it was really just trying to explore what was it did I, with people who are interested, what did I do while I was there? Well, let's do what I did as best I know how to practice it, as best I know how to communicate it. And so then, so I just started, it was really that exploration. And then somebody really wrangled me. They were working with a group of high school students in Milwaukee, and they just read in the, you know, I was in a play, and they read in my bio that I'd done this work. She said, I've heard of that, and you have to come do it with my students.
Oh,
she was quite insistent. And so I borrowed an electric piano and hauled myself up to Milwaukee and just started working with them, playing with them. And in fact, they had just done a production of The Wizard of Oz. And I was like, oh, great, let's start with The Witch, which is an archetype that I'd worked with my Roy Hart teachers. And then I just kind of started saying, well, what else can we do? And so I just started grabbing roles, characters from The Wizard of Oz and placing them, starting with a kind of a place in the body where we would center that and using pitch. And I still use The Wizard of Oz. I mean, that was in, I'm not even going to remember, 1998, 1997, 1998. And I still use it because The Wizard of Oz is quite archetypal. Even if people haven't seen the film, if they're in a group of people who know it, they will pick it up very quickly. At least in the U.S., I found that it's more difficult in Europe. If nobody has a context for The Wizard of Oz, it doesn't work. So and with that workshop, that was really the moment when I taught that workshop, and I thought that there's something here that I think I would really like to investigate, and I'm passionate about. And I felt something was happening in the room in that moment.
Would you rather go in one direction or another?
Let's go with the MFA. I feel like I have a clearer vision.
Okay.
Right, so at this moment.
How many students would you have in a class like this?
10.
A winter session. 10. This is during the winter, and sort of what time of day does it occur? How many times a week?
Usually in the morning, 3 times a week, bright and early. Usually 9, sometimes 9:20. If we can move to schedule.
If we can stretch it.
Yes.
And the class lasts how long?
90 minutes.
So that, I'm guessing that means that most of them don't have a class before.
That's correct.
Okay. So it's the first thing that they're coming into the day doing.
Yep.
So let's say we're sort of a third the way through, so in maybe the fourth week or so. Again, it's like, it's, let's say it's 10:15. The door opens and time stops. And I walk in, but time is completely frozen. And I look around the room, and I first see where the teacher is, which happens to be you. Are you alone, or are there other teachers in the room?
I'm the only teacher in the room.
Okay. I don't know how I figured it out. It was you. How would I know that you were the teacher?
That is actually a great question, because it's kind of the moment that you're freezing where, because we're in a circle or a oval of some kind, you know, circle-ish group. I'm not sure if you would know who the teacher was in this particular moment. The clues would be, I'm on the floor on a zafu, a meditation cushion. Sitting on a cushion of some kind. I'm the one who does not have a yoga mat. Probably everybody else would have a yoga mat, 10, a circle or oval of 10 yoga mats. I would not have a yoga mat. And I would have kind of a little a briefcase that stands on the floor with papers and such in it. I would have probably a packet with maybe some notes, notebook near me. And I have a small digital alarm clock in front of me.
That's a lot of property.
I got some props around me. And other people, well, I don't know if that's the question you want me to answer or not.
Go ahead.
But other people would have they'd each have a Zafu. They would have the yoga mat. They may or may not have kind of a packet of material or a notebook. Some of them would, some of them wouldn't.
So let's go, because you started by describing yourself sitting on the Zafu. Mm-hmm. So how would you describe your body's position, just yours, before we talk about anybody else?
Yeah, I'm actually going to sit on one. I have one right here. I can describe it while I'm doing it. So okay. I have 1 foot flat on the floor with the knee up,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is if I were sitting cross-legged, it would be in the cross-legged position. So my knees is pointing toward the ceiling, and then my right knee is pointing toward the wall in that direction. And then I have my hands clasped around my shin. This is a classic Phil teaching position. As I sit here, I go, wow, I do this a lot. I will switch legs, but that is the classic position.
It means that your which knee is raised?
My left knee is raised.
So your right foot is passing under your...
Yes,
your
exactly.
And your hands are clasped, as in your fingers are sort of interlocked
mm-hmm.
around your shin.
Mm-hmm.
Are you attentive to what's happening in your own body in that position? As in not what the image of your body is, but like being maybe what would you be attentive to in your own body in that moment?
Mm.
Or are you not thinking about your body?
I'm not thinking about my body really. I think I'm more tuned into the student.
And you said singular, the student.
Yeah, there'd be one student is working this moment.
Okay. Before we get into that, I'm this moment still frozen and I'm scanning the room and I might have not picked up on the fact that you have this timer or clock and
mm-hmm.
this briefcase and that you don't have a yoga mat. Maybe I'm just blind to forms of property. I notice your posture, but I get confused and I think that someone else is the teacher in the class.
Mm-hmm.
What's their position? Why might it be that I trip up and think that somebody else is?
I think there would be somebody who has a level of attention on the student who's working. I think also the physical posture would be a physical posture that is kind of definitely towards that one particular student who's working, a sense of thinking about what you see. There would definitely be, I mean, certainly their eyes would be on them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a level of leaning in, a little bit of leaning in.
Well,
other people.
They're sitting also?
Yes.
And they're leaning in, as in they're leaning forward?
Yeah. Leaning forward. Yeah.
But you're saying other people, sorry.
Yeah, because other people might be more reclining, even that, right? The attention might be slightly less focused on the person working.
Mm-hmm.
Less laser-like.
Mm-hmm.
I also I would say that it's likely that the people you see that if their attention is on the person and their jaw is released, lips are parted, that I think would be a visual cue that this person might be, if you're going to say, who is the teacher? Possibly somebody.
Okay, great. Well, there's certainly at least two other kinds of individuals in the room to go into besides the wrong teacher with their lips parted. They're you said leaning forward.
Yeah.
A sort of, you said laser focus.
Yeah.
I don't have a sense of how they're leaning forward. What's the difference, actually, first staying with them for a second? What's the differences in how their arms are composed versus yours or their knees?
Yeah. Kind of a couple people one person is sitting cross-legged. I think the person I was kind of seeing that I thought, oh, this person might seem as though their teacher cross-legged, hands in their lap, leaning slightly forward, in the upper body, kind of leaning forward.
That's the wrong teacher.
Yes, that's a wrong teacher. That's the main wrong teacher I'm seeing. There's also somebody to the side of the person who's working, who's looking up. It seems like would be an awkward position to teach from. But they're sitting not cross-legged, but with the legs to one side, right? Feet to one side, looking up. Again, focus. So I suppose visually the thing that I kind of envision as a prompt of who the teacher is the eyes, I suppose. Beyond kind of other less objective, more presence-oriented senses of focus, there'd be, where are the eyes?
Can we get into talking about the student that's working? Where are they in relationship to you?
They are not directly across the kind of circly ovalish thing, but kind of across, but to one, a little bit to one side. So not like there'd be, I guess, there's 11 of us. I'm not sure I can do that math. Four people to one side of me, and then that student, and on the other side there would be five. So a little off center, but fairly across the circle.
Which knee is up again?
Well, my left knee is up. They're slightly to the left.
Okay.
They're closer to my left side, yeah.
So you're kind of looking across your hip a little bit slightly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not from your perspective, but from my perspective, having walked in the room, what do I see of that student?
So they're standing. And they are in the midst of addressing the circle of people that they are with. So they're slightly, not quite in the circle, as it were, not quite in line with everybody. They've stepped forward a step or two. They're kind of a weight is on their right foot. Head a little bit towards the right. Arms seem to be in mid-gesture. Mouth is open, a little bit of a smile.
And
as if they're in the midst of telling a funny story.
And telling a funny story
to the 10 of us, the 10 people in the circle.
And the laser focus of the two wrong teachers. Where is that laser focused on in terms of the student?
It's focused on they're focused on the actor's face.
On the face.
Mm-hmm.
Does it seem any more particular than that?
I would say the eyes.
What about the other way around? What's the position of the eyes that I start to walk across the room. I don't know yet really what the room looks like, but there's this oval and maybe I entered somewhere behind you.
Uh-huh.
Is that true?
Yeah, more or less. So I would be kind of sitting almost like if you walked in and just went straight through that door, you'd walk directly behind me.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I walk in and I see this student in profile or head on.
You walk in and they are to your right.
Mm-hmm.
About a 75 degree angle if you're kind of flat with the door. And they are facing more or less some kind of towards you.
So
it would be very easy for you to walk in and feel like, oh, I'm a part of the conversation right away.
A part of their conversation.
Yes.
As if they were addressing me directly.
Exactly. That you were a part of the group they were addressing.
So if I'm walking in, actually the focus of their eyes, the person that's doing the work right now, would they feel directed at me?
I don't think so, because I think they're addressing this circle, there's a sense of, I think that their sense of focus is kind of above the heads of the seated people.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of that kind of distant sense of when you're describing, when you're talking about a memory or a sensation to a person or a group of people, and your gaze is to the distance to try to kind of see it, relive
mm-hmm.
it. So I think you would, I don't think you would think they were looking right at you, but
mm-hmm.
I think you would feel like if you were a late student coming in, then you could imagine that you could just kind of sneak right into the circle and be a part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think their focus would be a broad enough to communicate to the circle and to really the whole room.
Then if I walk towards them and around and look back towards you, where are you looking?
I'm looking at the student's face.
Okay. And what you described, like the slack jaw of
yes.
the wrong student, right?
Yes. Yes.
What's the composure of your face?
Yeah, same thing. My jaw is open. Lower jaw, lower mandible. Yeah.
I wonder if we can again pull some time back in slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And just say, you know, like 1 second first. In one second elapsing, what would I hear? No one noticed that I was there within that 1 second.
The student, you'd hear a bit, you know, 1 second of the text the student is speaking.
Mm. So this text, is it in their hands in some ways?
No, it's memorized.
Okay. And what quality of sound could you imagine being a part of that 1 second of
text? I think in this moment, I think this the quality was fairly strong.
Mm-hmm. Strong in what way?
A sense of strong in terms of resonance, strong in terms of intent.
Mm-hmm.
Strong in terms of, I think the
clear, the consonant, whatever kind of consonant came in, would be very clear in terms of its articulatory action. So just to say, in terms of the kind of the in terms of which also what you see in terms of the actor's communication, the eyes very bright, intense.
And if we add another 10 seconds, what might happen over those 10 seconds, or what do you see happening?
So 10 more seconds of the actor living out the text. Not a lot of physical, movement through space, not a lot of kinesthesia, but certainly a gestural life, making some eye contact. He'd be making eye contact with the class.
Are those moments of eye contact and the gestures that come with it, what relationship do they have with the sort of world of what they're saying? Are they in some ways enlisting you in dialogue of it, or are they looking at you because you're watching them? Does that make sense? The difference?
Yeah, they actually. I mean, within the role that the actor is playing, they are enlisting this group of people to try to help them work out a problem.
Okay, a problem in the text, not about the text.
The character has a problem that they're trying to work out for themselves, and so they're using us to help figure that out, work through it.
Okay, so they're like giving almost like a rhetorical.
Basically, it's a soliloquy. So it's a soliloquy from Shakespeare in which the actor addresses the audience to try to work out some problem, to enlist their help to work out some problem.
What in this? So let's let time go wherever it wants to. as long as it wants to. What would be some of the changes that happen on the part of the semicircle, be that you or including yourself, as a part of that within, let's say, within the time of the soliloquy? Would there be any changes in the sound of the people that are around, or the movement of them, or their eye movement, or their faces that would respond to or change in relationship to the soliloquy?
Yeah, I mean, people might shift just to be more comfortable. They might. Yeah. I think there would be laughter in this particular moment. People would laugh. I think people would be kind of moments of surprise, so the physicalities of surprise, of raised eyebrows or movement, head movement, hand movement, head drops to the chin, drops to the chest out of surprise, eyebrows raised out of surprise, laughter.
And everybody, go ahead.
As I think about my kind of movement responses, tend to be a little bit forward in terms of kind of, I guess it's really my upper body, which is mobile in this position, and kind of my kind of from the head, spine, torso, leaning forward, nodding, as if an encouragement. Also, that would be kind of my, and definitely laughing too.
But that's interesting that you say, like, also in terms of encouragement, like, what is some of the difference in how I would start to see you maybe more as a teacher there in that semicircle in terms of your attention and reaction than others?
Yeah, I think that most of the other students' reaction would be based on really almost as if they were the audience at a production. In other words, they are simply in the world listening to this person in imaginary these circumstances working out this problem. Whereas I am kind of working on almost a double consciousness where sometimes that is happening for me too, especially moments of surprise and something that's especially moving in some way. I simply respond as the audience was. But the other part of me is noting what's happening that we've been working on that is of, you know, that's noteworthy. And I think the encouragement comes as I think about this moment is that sense of something that is really working well, where what we've been working on merges with this moment of theater. Kind of nodding my head as if, yeah, that's it, as though that, you know, is if, my intention, the odd thing is, as I think about it, is my intention is not to actually have the actor notice that. Right? I mean, it's a weird thing. I never really considered it, but if somebody's running the bases, and I'm nodding in encouragement, I actually, if they look over, I would want them to see me and notice. Yes, 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 right? Mm-hmm. Maybe, I suppose I feel I want them to feel that energy of, yes, I'm with you, right? Without necessarily having them stop to note what I'm actually doing.
I'm imagining there is one student that is... that is also kind of playing this double, right? That maybe is not also fully within, I don't want to say in a realm of disbelief rather than suspending disbelief, but that somebody else is sort of riding between these two. But let's say, at what point after the soliloquy what happens then? Like, how do the others emerge from this other world, or from this, as you said, being in the world, at the end of the soliloquy, I guess.
Yeah, most people in the room make a physical shift. So once the soliloquy is done, there's a sense of everybody kind of takes a breath and does a physical shift. I usually kind of break the, sometimes there's, let's let a little bit of silence be there. Mm-hmm. And so at some point I break into making the shift to having us talk about what just happened. But there's almost always a physical shift that happens as kind of the final moment falls. There's a suspension. There's a letting go, and everybody usually shifts, sometimes breathes, sometimes makes a sound.
Mm-hmm. And their attention goes where? Where does where do they turn their head even?
Oh, yeah. So some people stay with the actor who just worked, to kind of have a moment of, you know, those two together. Mm-hmm. Some people kind of move, kind of turn, kind of head down or away as a moment to kind of gather their own sense of self and thoughts, collect themselves, as it were. And a couple of people turn towards me.
They turn towards you because there is a habit that you would be the first one.
That's right. That's right. Yes, into the next moments, and they know what's coming next.
What about the attention of the student that just worked?
That student kind of goes back into themselves, head to the floor, physically moving, physically moving, and take a few steps, head down, and then eventually they sit down.
And how does either once they sit down or within the steps forward or back, how does their relationship change to the other students around the circle? Because they had just, in the soliloquy, they had been in some ways gesturing towards them and making eye contact with a few of them, right?
Yeah, I think it's a real separation from that, from those that relationship that they had been developing. Separating that was the imaginary circumstance relationship within the circumstances. That's gone. They can come back to themselves.
Just a little bit more, if you have time for it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because I'd love to get back into this other part. What you're the first to speak. Can you describe what you, or I'm, let's say, what I hear, since I'm still in the room, but now I'm invisible.
Yep.
What do I hear when you start to speak?
Yes, I start with something simple and encouraging. Of very nice or good, or that's, I mean, I may say something very specific like that's come a long way. We've seen it before. I might just say, great. And then I would say, what did you all notice? What was striking to you? What struck you in that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm maybe explaining too much, but just then, but the idea that that's not true. What I do is I say very nice, and I say to the person who just worked, I say, what did you find? That's usually my prompt. My usual prompt is, what did you find? So that they can talk about what their experience was.
And if I didn't understand the words that were coming out of your mouth, how could you describe what I was hearing?
I think there would be a sense of warmth, pleasure, encouragement.
And how does the
openness? Yeah. Openness, and there's a sense of a ball has been tossed for the other person to then, take up. I've given away the talking stick, as it were.
Right. Is there any way of describing the difference between that and the quality of sort of voice or almost sonic patterns that were in the soliloquy itself?
I think that this particular soliloquy that came up has a lot of punchiness to it, kind of punching, and a lot of suddenness to it, a lot of very strong. And I think that that my vocal response is much lighter, although it's warm but light, much freer, more sustained.
In thinking about Roy Hart, and is there another exercise that you could lead us through? It's an exercise maybe you use in some of these classes, but exercises that you feel like are fully your own that may have been inspired by other terrains, but don't necessarily.
Yes, yeah. I, as I said, it's you know, I'm like a magpie. So it's like, what, or that's not quite it, because I don't quite steal the thing and then keep it. It's like it becomes, it's like an alchemist, a magpie
Right.
alchemist. Steal things from people, they get transformed as I do them, and then I don't even know what the original metal was, right? to try to continue my alchemy image. Yeah, certainly we can. So I suppose we could just start with just a nice, think of it an easy, whatever this means to the listener at this moment, of kind of letting breath come into the body, maybe a hand under the belly button somewhere.
Are we standing or sitting? Does it
matter? I like to stand.
Okay.
I think standing is a great way. Again, you might think about finding those two tripods of your feet, your knees kind of soft, meaning that they're not locked, not in a deep plié. And just a nice kind of sensing of breath coming and going on its own. And then just a nice, easy, this breath's going to go, and we'll just do a little easy, easy, fluffy bit of sound. Huh. As the breath goes new rhythm. Huh. Nice. Huh. You can let the breath come and go on its own. It might be sometimes more of a sigh. Trying to feel a bit of expansion in the belly. Maybe you can feel the ribs mobile. You might be going to use your hands to feel that. Nice. And then trying to keep the jaw released. So lips are parted. And then you're going to keep the jaw released, but close the lips. Just to feel a little vibration. Yeah, even just very little effort, just letting the breath, you're not in any hurry for anything to happen. Nice. And then let the lips part at the end. So we have a little, it's kind of like there's a vowel. It's kind of like a two vowel word. Nice. And then you can start to feel perhaps some vibrations in the lips. This is the really a kind of resonance. And you might be able to feel the vibrations grow in a sense. Now, there's travel from the lips, the teeth, nose, cheeks, just wherever you feel it. Nice. And then just start to let your imagination kind of maybe take you somewhere. And since we're on radio, I will ask you, is there a particular what's bubbling in your imagination there, Tim?
Fish, like an image of somebody fishing.
All right, well, go with your fishing. Fishing.
Okay.
And sounding. Off you go.
Do you want me to describe more?
No, just sounding. Nice. You can think. Nice. You can think about casting with the sound, casting the fishing line going out. Nice. You maybe point with the finger. Maybe actually do the action. Nice. 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 Yes. Now you're kind of becoming, I'm hearing you kind of become the fishing line. So be the fishing line. Yes. Nice. You are the fishing line. Nice. Get a little bit. So some different pitches are coming in there. Play with that a little bit. Oh, yes. Nice. It's a little desperate. I hear a little desperation. Go right into that. Nice. Make sure you let breath connect to breath before you sound. Nice. Nice. Good. 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 What's happening now?
I think that there's the lead is getting heavier on the end of the line.
Yes. Very nice. Good. Good. Right. That's very nice. Good. So that's just kind of a little moment of right. Whatever image, right, the image that comes out, whatever gets revealed, you can follow both with your right body, breath, voice, imagination, all coming, whatever that happens to be. I'll just, I'm gonna feed one to you just because it's kind of a juicy image, which is this, and think very suspicious, right? Archetypally suspicious. There you go. Nice. Nice. And is a character or a part of you kind of starting to bubble up in terms of imagination?
Yeah, kind of like a, maybe in terms of like a kind of character archetype, but sort of like fool or trickster.
Yes, go for it. Yes, go. Go very trickster. Just dive in. Nice. Nice, very nice. Nice. And so, yeah, so you're trapped. So this kind of place, I'm just to kind of stop and talk a moment.
Yeah.
So this kind of place of starting with the voice, really just lips, teeth, that place. Now you're starting to follow the archetype wherever that archetype wants to go. So just to, right. Mm-hmm. So you're going through the passaggio to the head voice, right? Right. I'm hearing that. Right, and you're also going down into the creek or the fry register. Right, so right the place in the body connected to the imagination then takes us in different places, and so you're kind of and so there are kind of two paths as I've experienced working in kind of a with the Roy Hart teachers I've worked with, which is at this moment in time you can either follow your archetype wherever it wants to go, which is kind of what I'm encouraging you to do and what you're doing. So, or you can kind of stay with the structure of and feeling really feeling where we're feeling that in the lips, nose, cheeks, and move and stay with that and find what's in there. Where does the trickster live in there? And that's where. In the kind of Roy Hart tradition, one uses the piano to a great extent. The idea that a note on a piano can lead you, it becomes a map of a map that you can find into the woods, out of the woods of your own kind of self imagination and so forth. And so there's kind of these two paths of playing and finding both kind of improvising wherever you want to go or staying with a much more determined, if I stay with this note and this part, this embodied part of my voice, what is there? What is there? And if I change that by a half tone on a piano, what else, what becomes new and where do the shifts happen? So there's kind of a playful moving way, and then there's a slower delving forward way.
So the two paths being one that a piano, for example, or some external thing affects how you change and then reimagine things, and the other being internal kind of playing and following an archetype,
yeah,
or playing and following just moving direction, for example, of vibration.
Yeah. 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 And sometimes, and then there, sometimes those things can mix. So, so if one is, if we're improvising, right, with our trickster, and we find that creaky sound, that fry register, then we could decide from the, in a sense, from an external central nervous system place, ooh, let's explore that. Right.
Right.
So I might say, right, how relaxed can you keep that creak?
Okay.
And what is,
so,
right, and what does that reveal about your trickster, right?
Right.
Your, does you, right? If we, if we, if we, so there's this, there's so so how much kind of either an external source of the piano, which is a, it's a, the piano can be just a brilliant teacher
right,
on its own, but also the central nervous system becomes in a way also a teacher or an or a leader, a guide.
I think that that's what's so incredible about this, is that the multiplicity of places that the, let's say, role of a teacher is,
yeah,
but also its relationship to the the imaginary or imagination and its influence. Because, I mean, I think at first I'm just struck by this sort of oscillating back and forth between, you know, something's happening in my voice and my body that I'm both hearing and producing and feeling. That's affecting, like you sort of told me, what do you imagine from this thing that we're doing kind of technically, physically, in resonance? What is it making you think, without even giving me kind of a terrain of what kind, like an activity or whatever? What does it make you think? And so that's imagination, but then you let that imagination affect, obviously, how that thing is producing itself. You say you go with something, or like you say, go with that, right? And so the teacher then becomes one's own imagination, and then rather than the sound that you're producing. And I think that that's so important and interesting, because, like, at the same time, it's, you know, a way of thinking, if we're going back to acting, or what a voice is, finding the voice of something else, let's say, or create, or creating, or embodying an archetype, a fool or trickster or something, that what that then is like letting the archetype also be the teacher in some way, but also at the same time teaching the archetype from your own body.
That's right.
And your own imagination.
That's right.
I think that that's so beautiful. It's such a crazy connection between, you know, somatics, like self-feeling of your body, pedagogy in terms of teaching, and acting.
Yeah. The you know the teacher is often just a, you know, the witness. Another one of my colleagues, Dexter Bullard, calls himself an expert witness. That's a lot of his work, is just being the expert witness while the work is happening with the people who are doing the work.